Let me explain the basics of what we understand by knowing something, by having a cognition. We have two sides, the perception, the percept given by observation of a certain field, of course. We never observe everything, we are always in a certain awareness field, and that's what we focus at now. And we have, on the other hand, the concepts we bring into this field comes from a completely different source. It doesn't come through observation, it comes through intuition. But here the word is used in a technical sense by getting a concept into our mind, not something vague. And the ideal is we have a synthesis in our field of observation, of percept and concept. They must be congruent, like two triangles in geometry can be congruent. And as simple as that sounds, we practically daily go against this idea of knowledge, cognition, mainly by making two mistakes. First, we overlook some percepts in our field, we don't pay attention to them. So there's a lack of concepts which we would send to this sphere, we don't. So there is an overload of of a field which is not permeated by concepts. It's empty of concepts. On the other hand, the other mistake that is very, very daily done by practically all of us is we have concepts which go beyond what we actually perceive. We could say simply, and you all know what that is, we make a generalization. We see a person once and the person seems to be making jokes continuously, and we go away and say to our friends, "Oh, I've met a very humorous person today." Did you? No, you did meet someone who made a few jokes. But you generalize. Out of what you have perceived, you make a generalization which is not justified in what you have experienced. Because that person is maybe a very deep melancholic, and you happened to meet him in the only 5 minutes of his weeks or months in which he was in a good humorous mood. So generalization is going beyond what you actually perceive. Now, this has deep also social implications. We tend to go always much further with our concepts, which then combine in judgments, in the sense of making not a value judgment, but a judgment, this person is a humorous person, without having a basis in observation. Also, science does this. You all know about this deadly virus today, and some cute people who were good observation people claimed one hasn't observed it in an isolated form. So you have a concept which is not fulfilled by being anchored in a percept. This is not scientifically sound and serious, but it happens all the time. So the synthesis is an ideal which is even in everyday life difficult to fulfill, and also in science. Whenever science gets speculative, hypotheses, you don't go along the principle to only produce thoughts into the concrete field of observation you are confronted with. So it is it's an art, so to speak, to restrict oneself in one's thinking, to apply one's thinking to what one actually sees. And I give you another example. It comes from the great political event of 9/11. A friend of mine, Gerhard Wisniewski, who is maybe not known to all our listeners, went to Shanksville. Is it Shanksville? The city in Pennsylvania?
Charlottesville?
No, not Charlottesville, but something with Will. It's the place where the fourth plane allegedly went down by hijackers. And all one could see there was a little hole in which I think not even a small car would have fitted in. And some debris, some, you know, there was some sacks with rubbish in it. And Wisniewski went there and talked to the mayor of the city. And they went to the place, to the field where it was allegedly falling down. And Wisniewski asked the man, "Now, where did you see the plane going into the ground?" And he was almost stupefied, the mayor, and said, "There was no plane. There was no plane." So he didn't actually observe a plane. But of course, he had heard the daily news for days and weeks, and the news claimed there was a plane. So there must have been a plane. And then he said, "Well, probably it evaporated in the air." That's another good example for not fitting in the field of your observation what you think about what is there, and it is actually not there. That's another example of a non-exact synthesis. I think the basic thing was true that the man said, "I didn't see any plane," but he couldn't come up with that in the American public, because the whole public was made to believe, of course, there was a plane. And it shows another difficulty in everyday interpretation of what we actually see. Now, this is a simple thing with huge consequences. Another example of how it is difficult to be exact in what we apply from our thinking capacity to what we see, that if we make a simple experiment and say, imagine, now here where we two are discussing, the door would open, and who would step in? Whom would you like to step in?
Trump.
President Trump. Ex-President Trump. Okay, probably by a great error, he may be thinking that is the White House of Switzerland or some cabinet of a secret meeting. Anyway, he's here. What are we doing? We see his movements. We see his clothes. We see his face, we see the color of his face, then he speaks, we listen to the words he says, and then out of some impulse that we might not know, he leaves the room again. 5 minutes. Now, everything we should do if we want to train us in being exact in cognition of what we perceive actually is follow the sight, what he presents, follow the words, follow the meaning of the words, if there is any. Because there are many people who speak without that you could discover any meaning in it. But let's say he would even say some things that are thoughtful. We register that. We register the tone of his voice. And that's all. Then he leaves. That's all we have to restrict ourselves if later we want to say what we have observed and what we have thought about it. But you can imagine the huge difficulty would be when the door opens and Mr. Trump comes in, a whole swarm of things you believe to know about him from, of course, the wonderful media immediately surge up. And of course, with most people, the strongest emotions surge up, like I hate this man, and or some people would maybe say, if they are Democrats, what a wonderful man. All superfluous. It doesn't belong to the process you want to exercise. Because it comes not from the immediate field of your experience, which I call field of observation. It comes from your whole being, from your memories, from the past, from outside. Now imagine, if that we would practice, we would actually practice exact knowledge to arrive at exact cognition. Now, cognition and knowledge, I use them as synonymous, but I hope it's clear what is meant. That would have a great impact, not only that it is a good scientific principle to go about things like that, it is also keeping the social sphere free from what we can call prejudice, all the past elements that we project when we see somebody, which doesn't come out of the immediate experience. That would free a lot of things in the social sphere. If you would have the ability to meet everyone, if we want, in a way as if we have never met the person before, then we would be very attentive to what we can experience now. And we are not used to that. So from that point of view, you can get a great respect of the art of forming a conviction about something which is actually before in front of your eyes, and leave all the past things away as if it was the biggest rubbish in the world, because it doesn't help me to understand what I see now. I think that is one of the greatest difficulties in everyday life, in science, to really keep to what we actually perceive. One of the great geniuses of this faculty was, you will not be surprised, Goethe. Goethe was able to look and to stay a long time with what he actually saw. Before he was trying to see the spiritual, the conceptual background of this. Whereas we are generally really jumping over what we see, going to concepts, don't really see that they don't fit or don't fit well. And the whole age is permeated with a rush into concepts after superficial observation. Now, this is a basic thing, just what we have with to understand that cognition always needs these two poles, observation, percept, thinking, concept, but they must be related in a as exact manner as possible, and which is presents, as I said, already in the daily life, a huge difficulty. Now, the percept side, usually, of course, is sense perceptions, things that we could say are belonging to the material world. And if we make this looking at what we observe systematic, then we come to science. Science is nothing else than to look in a disciplined way into the world, into what the senses present us with, and then to understand this with permeating it with concepts. That's the basic principle. Now, of course, we can have non-material perceptions. Some of you would doubt that and say that's impossible. And if you in fact ask any person you might know or yourself, what is science? The answer mostly given immediately is natural science. That means dealing with material things in the sense world. But natural science is only one type of science. You cannot define what is scientific by the object you observe, the percept. If you observe and have the ability to observe, say, etheric processes, living processes, you can do the same, you can try to understand them. But of course, this is not physical material anymore. So one must not fix the idea of a scientific research to the type of percept which you have involved. Because there are ethereal, there are astral, soul percepts, there is spiritual realities, and that is now a matter of development of the individual, if you are able to see beyond the physical. Okay, let me sum up. You could say, to know what science is today really answered in the question in a short-sighted way. Like, it would be the same if you asked someone, what is a triangle? And then you answer, this triangle, which is maybe very harmoniously built, and this is your favorite, and you like that. And then you could say, this is not the triangle, this is just one specimen. And there are all sorts of triangles that are much beyond your special triangle. So the idea or the concept is much larger than your special mental picture of it. And in the same way, if you say natural science is science, you do the same absurdity as saying this special formed triangle is the triangle. So science can be, of course, of a living, of a soul, or of a spiritual reality. And that's a matter of perception. The perception usually today is limited to the material physical field, but it must not necessarily be. And you can train yourself. Or it can happen spontaneously that you realize, I have experienced something which is not only physical, which is maybe has to do with the life. I give you a personal example. It's not very deep, but it shows, I think or I hope, what I want to talk about. Everyone has habits, strong habits. And maybe sometimes you see some of these habits are worth to be killed. It would be better to kill habits than to kill other people. Maybe there's even a relation in not killing bad habits to killing other human beings. Anyway, if you make an attempt to get rid of one habit, say in a year, that can be a great achievement which leads you to an experience of something which you didn't have before. Now in my case, and I only give you an example of one habit which I have happened to kill. I would be happy if I would be able to kill many more habits, but that's now not a discussion. So what did I do? For 15 years I was a strong smoker. And one day I was fed up out of various reasons. And I stopped, so to speak, in the middle of the process from 1 hour to the next. And I was so decided to get rid of that stupid habit for me. For other people, maybe it's necessary. That's another question. That I even didn't care to throw away the last packages or the last package of Camels, which I used to smoke at that time. It was in my apartment. One day, not long after that, I woke up after an intensive dream. What was the dream? I was smoking very intensively. And then I observed what was going on. Because there are two options, I think it can happen, that then you fall back, you see, oh no, this is not over, oh, very good, very lucky that I still left a package of cigarettes down there. You go down and in you are again. It didn't happen. I was surprised and I was, of course, happy. Nothing. So what did I experience? If you have a bit of knowledge of spiritual science, then you know we have a physical body, we have a life body, we have an astral body, we will come to that later. We have an ego, the I, spiritual center. Now all the habits are connected with the life body in us. And when you break a habit, as I did in that example I'm using now, then, and you dream in such a way that you can clearly see, no, your soul, your passionate nature is not involved at all. What is the dream showing you? And for me, it was clearly showing the reality of the life body connected to habits, which goes on for a while with your habit, even if your habit from a soul point of view has been dissolved. So what I'm saying is you make a new experience. It was my first experience of part of the etheric body, which is conservative, repetitive. And if you stop one thing which is in that etheric body, suddenly, I think it is good to have an example where you do it just from one moment to the next. Your soul life is freed, but the astral and your etheric body still goes on. And that is produced in an imaginative image in the dream. It's a trivial example, but for me it was quite revealing. That, oh, I have not only a passionate soul which has now be victorious with one little habit, I'm not very proud, but still, but you have also a life body which was surprised, which was not yet ready to accept that the habit so-and-so has gone. That is just a personal experience, and of course you can make exercises to train yourself to realize the etheric in you or in nature in a more general way, not detached to your own person. But I don't think it matters where you start. But that gave me the insight, yes, there are other things to be observed than just physical or even soul realities. And if they are understood and studied in the same way that you study how a leaf is built, the structure of the leaves, the mathematical structure in nature, that's fine. In such an exact sense, you can also start to study the supersensible realities within yourself or in nature. And that gives full justification to speak of spiritual science, which goes even higher, not the etheric, not only the astral, but the spiritual realities which you start when you're meeting your own ego being. Your ego being is a spiritual reality. So there is spiritual science, and that is what I want to outline briefly. It's a full justification, and I think it's important, because if you don't understand this, then you have maybe a materialistic world conception on one hand, follow natural science, And on the other hand, you have a kind of a mystical outlook into the world, which is seems to be more spiritual, but is vague, is unexact. And that is a discrepancy, which is not healthy. And I think if you want to have a short idea about the historical importance of spiritual science as introduced to humanity by Rudolf Steiner, you can say he did nothing else than expand the basic method of scientifically look at things to non-material things, but with the same exactness, so that you don't have exact signs of the physical and vague dreams of the mystical spiritual spheres, which is very, very often the case. I think nobody would accept a fruit of a natural scientific process, a technical fruit like a watch or a handy, if he would be told before he buys it, this was the product of a mystical insight of the inventor. You would not have the trust that it works, and this is justified. But in spiritual matters, people are often accepting the fruits of not an exact spiritual research road taken, but something vague, and this is not healthy. And Steiner saw that natural science is, of course, absolutely necessary. The technical fruits are necessary. They can be dangerous. But that human beings need an approach to the non-physical, which is as exact as the approach to the physical world with the material fruits that we all know or suffer from. So it's not against, as some people believe, any natural scientific insight. On the contrary, many things that were researched in spiritual science were actually, sometime later, maybe confirmed by natural scientists from their point of view. So this is maybe enough for the basic. We can come back in a later talk about details of this, but natural science and spiritual science are not contradictions, but are complementary. And we are not used to go into spiritual science out of the following reasons. It needs some activity. And we used to be passively given the truths of the scientists. In spiritual science, activity is key. And it starts already with the faculty of our thinking that we have been talking about. Thinking is an active process, and many people today are not used to that, and they are even afraid of it. So thinking is at the point of vanishing from the planet. And that's the reason why words become so all important and often catchwords. There is no clear thought behind it, but there is an emotional energy together with these words. We have lately, I think at the lunch, discussed a formulation we found in a shop outside. What was it? The distance is in reality the new nearness. Nobody can think anything concretely with this, but it sounds as if distancing is an achievement of a great progress, inner moral progress, which is ridiculous. Thinking is really a good or a virtue which is on the point of vanishing. And of course, for all the dictators and manipulators in our world, this is ideal. This is wonderful. You just give, instead of thoughts, you give catchwords, you give formulations, and people then fight about them and are busy with the verbal level of all these things. I must say, even some anthroposophists have fallen prey to these tendencies. I followed about 10 or 15 years ago a discussion about the titles of translations of books of Steiner's, which were not palatable again anymore. For example, one of the basic books is about the human being. It's called The Study of Man, old translation. The Study of Man. What is a human being? What is man? Physical, etheric, astral, spiritual, etc. And some people said, well, now we can't use that translation anymore, that title. So we should name it newly. And then they said, now we translate it with the study of the human being. Because man is only the male, which is ridiculous. So even in anthroposophy, in the anthroposophical movement, not in anthroposophy, we always have to distinguish the spiritual being of anthroposophy from the people who claim to be adherents for a certain time. Now, here I have a document, maybe to make it a bit lighter, this serious, grave discussion on what is cognition. I will show you a document which has a historical value, because it shows that Steiner wanted that anthroposophy is looked at as a spiritual science and not as a mystical thing. And I found here somewhere, I think it was an island originally, the typescript of the first thesis, academic thesis ever done about anthroposophy and spiritual science. And this was written by a pupil of Steiner's called Walter Johannes Stein. I think we have been mentioning him in previous talks. And his typescript was sent over from Vienna in the closing month of the First World War to Berlin, where Steiner was located. And Steiner took the time and care to read it through. And not only that, he made numerous notes and wrote into this typescript his notes, and almost all the notes were, it comes later a bit more often, all these notes were actually absorbed by the writer for the final form of his thesis. He took all the notes, that's the blue things, in the middle of the sentences, incorporated them into his thesis, and handed it in the University of Vienna. And lo and behold, they accepted it. And of course they didn't know, and they wouldn't have accepted it if they would have known that this was partially, literally, a text written by Steiner and not by Stein. But it shows how important it was for Steiner to see that anthroposophy is presented as a serious science of the spiritual. And it even includes wonderful elaborations. One or two chapters that Steiner says, you better leave that away. For example, he thought he would also have to write about the mystery dramas. And Steiner gave him the advice, leave that away. That goes too far for you academic professors. And he did. So this was a wonderful thing to find, because nobody knew that. Not the anthroposophists around Steiner, not the people later, knew that the first thesis on spiritual science was, so to speak, a co-product of Steiner with one of his foremost pupils. And when he found that, we have made an edition. It's the only one so far of this thesis in book form, only in German, not the bestseller, you can imagine. Thorough thinking almost never leads to best-selling products. I hope there are exceptions of the rule, and I'm sure there are, but there are exceptions. And but it's there. There was also even once an English translation, a private one, but it was never published. So we published that in order to show that Rudolf Steiner wanted, I don't know how he would have looked at it today, that the academic world was shown that there is a serious core of scientific method in what he calls spiritual science. I also wanted to highlight that a little bit because today we have a tendency, and here are, by the way, whole sheets. I don't know whether you have seen that were written commenting single places. It's all Steiner's handwriting. And it was found in Ireland in a very strange way. I was once going there to meet his daughter, Stein's daughter, and she told me there are a few things in the garage. And I found these typescripts, put them together by a friend. They were loose typescripts, and some ends were already bitten by mice. So it was the last moment which this important document could be saved, which I did. And this is a symbol for the care of Rudolf Steiner that something solid is made to show the world anthroposophy is not just an alternative mystical thing, but it is a complementary deed to have not only materialistic science be there, for example, materialistic medicine, as we have today, but that there are exact modes of training your mind to become aware of higher realities. Because that fits the age of today, that we want to have knowledge which is exact, yes, and not some wishy-washy thing. And today we have no symptom of accident. We have some intellectualizing of anthroposophy, especially from America. The main person who is leading in this is privately a Mormon. That's fine. But if you study Mormonism, you can see Mormonism is not a very good instrument for understanding spiritual science. It's nothing against Mormonism, but it is really grotesque what you find in these pseudo-scientific editions of Steiner today. That's why I wanted to highlight the beginning. And this thesis of Stein is the first one. And I could say it is on the highest level. All that came afterwards, especially what we have now, is far below what was already there. So that's why I wanted to allow myself to put a kind of a historical perspective into the whole discussion of what spiritual science is. And this Stein, maybe I have to can add that also, was someone who had the courage to ask his teacher questions that other people didn't dare to ask. And so he asked, for example, what is your most important work in your eyes? Steiner was asked by Stein. And then Steiner said, nothing but the philosophy of spiritual activity with which we began. This will be still there when many other things have begun to be the background. And if you understand this book, and if you practice it, so to speak, You will find the whole content of anthroposophy in it. It's a key work. It's not just a philosophical work. But of course, it needs an excessive concentration to read it. And the concentration faculties today are in war. They are under attack. As everyone knows who sees the whole world going around constantly with something in the ears. Distraction, distraction, distraction. So it is not easier today than it was at that time to see the deep quality in such a basic work. And another question which Stein put to Steiner was, and if you wouldn't have become a Goethe scientist, which he became, and following Goethe developed your own spiritual scientific method and research, what would have been your core mission? And then Steiner answered simply, reincarnation and karma and the social question. And these are two things which come up in the end of his life very prominently. And in the last of our talks, I will talk about this. Steiner's core mission, which is on the line of spiritual scientific investigation, going beyond the physical, going beyond the ethereal, going into the history of the ego or the individuality, which has gone through past lives. That's at the highest, one of the highest fruits of spiritual science, concrete revelations of the past history of hundreds of individuals. It's in the world. It's there to be studied. And it will change the whole way of looking at biographies if one is going into it. And you will soon see looking at biography without reincarnation of karma is just scratching the surface. Nothing else.
A snapshot.
Snapshot. Yeah, exactly. It's not wrong, but it's totally insufficient, so to speak. So that's now a look at one of the highest results of spiritual science, which today I think is important that people know that. Especially in experiences come, experiences of karma and reincarnation come by themselves. This is the percept side, if you like. But they can be totally misunderstood by an untrained thought faculty. There are people who think they were this and that, and in reality, they might have had pre-earthly, before birth, encounters with some individuals, which soul, which made an impression, and that comes up. And so numerous errors of this on this field are possible. And today, there are spiritual powers in which we also find light brought into them by spiritual science, powers that want to confuse human beings, especially if they start to have spiritual experiences. They are ready to blur it, to confuse it. This is a reality you can meet if you look closely. So all the more, I think, the presence and the cultivation of spiritual science in the sense of how Steiner brought it into the world is not only necessary, it is a kind of a therapy against the tendency to fall into all sorts of spiritual illusions. They look deep, they look marvelous maybe, but they are illusionary. Now, maybe for the end, we could say to have these higher perceptions that are necessary for other than physical investigations that lead to materialistic science, for example, you need to train your soul to have, as I said, insight into the etheric, into the astral, into the spiritual, and then you develop faculties of consciousness which go beyond the normal daily consciousness. And let me shortly, towards the end, focus on our daily consciousness, healthy, which can be called object consciousness, in which you see, here I am, here sits my interview victim, and he is not me, and I am not him. We can call this object consciousness. Everything which comes into our normal consciousness is different than our subject, and this is necessary. Otherwise, we would confuse ourselves with everything we see and had the kind of a undeveloped consciousness like this happens in childhood. The good side is a child is merging with everything, which we lose later. So the normal consciousness is a subject consciousness, subject-object consciousness. And then we come to the stage, what we call in spiritual science, imagination. But not as a fancy, subjective fantasy thing, but as an image of what we perceive, not only physically, in image form. Of course, it's obvious that this has to do, it's very close to artistic processes of imagining things in poetry. But the whole humanity will go to this consciousness in the future. And the higher consciousness stage would be to have inspirations. But in an exact sense, again, not a wishy-washy thing like some people say, my belly. It's my belly feeling, and it means something very high, but it is not very high. Inspiration as a faculty to perceive, for example, what a departed person is trying to inspire into you. And there was a time in Europe, in the world, where some individuals showed that they wanted, they were ready to develop this sort of consciousness. And were coming into a certain insecurity because they didn't know what is the source of my inspiration. And the paramount example of this for Steiner was Friedrich Nietzsche. Nietzsche was having a lot of inspirations. You see that in his books. He could be inspired by departed people like Schopenhauer. He could be inspired by many beings, but he didn't have the security of knowing who is inspiring me. And in the end phase of his life, he was inspired by a being that is called in spiritual science, Ahriman. But he didn't know that. And that was contributing to his to the ruin of his mental health, so to speak. And that showed Steiner that today, when we rise beyond the object consciousness, come to imagination, come to inspiration, we need a higher consciousness still, which he calls, in a strict and exact technical sense, intuition. If you have intuition in that sense, you can start to see what is the source of inspiration. And you could have the freedom to say, I don't want to be inspired by this being. If you knew you that the inspirer of your soul is Ahriman, you could have had the freedom to say, no, thank you, I don't want that at the moment. And I don't want to be, in a way, possessed. So intuition is the highest faculty, and this faculty is already used in the basic book, The Philosophy of Spiritual Activity. Because this intuition faculty we all have already in our daily consciousness as a seed. When we find thoughts, thoughts show themselves as what they are. There is nothing behind them. If you have a thought, you have something which you know what it contains. We don't have that with any perception. There's always something behind. So in thoughts, we meet the world of intuition in our daily consciousness. And this is, so to speak, the lowest step on a ladder that can go high up into the world of the spirit. Steiner puts this one day in a lecture like that and says, if you think you're not clairvoyant, you have no chance to ever become it. Because if you want to develop a faculty, you must find the seed of it already now. And he pointed out that the seed of clairvoyance is flowing in ordinary clear thought consciousness already. That's the seed of a high faculty. By that he also shows we don't jump from ordinary consciousness into a higher one, but we can find in the ordinary consciousness some elements which betray that they have a higher quality already in them. And then the question is, how can we develop that? And for this, that would require another lecture, and that goes beyond our present aim. But there are, of course, all these training books, how to get knowledge of higher worlds and others, in which Steiner gives exact examples and methods of developing the higher faculties, so that we don't get clairvoyant, inspirational, like Nietzsche was, without knowing by what or by whom. So that's just a few sketches about what spiritual science is, can be for us, and how to achieve it. I think for today we close here. We will go, we have decided, maybe we can add that, to go through the number of subjects we have, I think, which is on the website, on the Solari, in a second go, and then we can specify. And if there is any comments or questions by listeners, we can work them in. Now we are on number two. The first was how to find the Christ, which was a special starting interest, lasting interest by Catherine. Now we had a sketch on spiritual knowledge. What is it? Next time we will have, tomorrow, history and evolution. What is the evolution from a spiritual point of view? And then we will have world economy, the threefold social order, occult politics, education and art, agriculture and health, self-development and meditation, the age of Ahriman and Michael. And I would like to close the series with Rudolf Steiner's core mission, reincarnation and karma. And so we go through all once, and then we repeat it and go a little bit deeper or further. And this is also a bit depending on what you, the listeners, find as questions or criticism or whatever. We'll try to work with that. Thank you for your attention. In German, we say, you know, in English and in French, you say, pay attention. It's almost a business. Pay, pay, the word pay. Pay attention. In German, you say, man schenkt jemandem Aufmerksamkeit. It's a gift. You give attention.
Give your attention.
So thank you for the attention you have given the speaker.
Thank you, Elia.